Ethan Elkind sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. Later in the program, we're going to discuss a recent expose by ProPublica about how United Healthcare is trying to limit mental health coverage and treatment for thousands of children with autism in order to cut costs and limit care to patients. But first, we're going to get the latest on the massive and devastating fires happening in Los Angeles, which have absolutely devastated several communities in multiple locations across Los Angeles County. Five wildfires fueled by anomalously dry conditions and strong Santa Ana winds have so far burned through 29,000 acres of land around LA since Tuesday. According to the LA Times, 10 people have died, but officials think the death toll is likely to be higher than that. More than 9,000 structures have burned, and at least 179,000 residents are under evacuation orders. Experts say LA is not out of danger yet, and these fires have the potential to be the costliest wildfire disaster in American history. Robert Luna, the Los Angeles County Sheriff, said some areas, quote, look like a bomb was dropped in them, and that I think the death toll will rise. So to get the latest about the scope of these devastating Los Angeles wildfires, we're joined by Noah Haggerty, an environment, health, and science reporter at the Los Angeles Times. Noah has been on the ground with several of his colleagues at the Times covering the fires. Noah, thanks so much for taking the time to join us. I'm sure you and your colleagues have just been overwhelmed trying to cover this unimaginable disaster.
Good morning, Ethan. Thank you so much for having me.
So Noah, again, just pleased you can join us. The fires obviously have been getting global attention just due to the size and their destructive nature, and because LA is such an important cultural, economic, population center for the United States and the world. Can you just give us an update on the latest that's happening right now? What's standing out to you in terms of the most recent developments?
So as of Friday morning, it seems like we might finally be turning a corner. The two largest fires, the Palisades fire and the Eaton fire, had sat at 0% containment through yesterday. But as of this morning, the Palisades fire is at 8% containment and the Eaton fire is at 3%. We had very, very severe winds on Tuesday, Wednesday, but coming into Thursday, the winds were dying down a bit, and we've had good firefighting conditions on Thursday, Friday, and that's expected to continue. Tomorrow, the winds at lower miles per hour have let fire crew bring out those heavy-duty air equipment and able to attack it from the air and make some significant progress and are working on the offensive to get these fires under control.
Well, Noah, it's great news that the winds have died down, providing a bit of a break, but I understand more severe winds are on the horizon. What is the forecast looking like, you know, out another week or two here?
It's looking like winds can pick up again on Sunday with some three major wind events throughout the next week with dry conditions continued. So this spells wildfire danger yet again. Officials are hoping to get some significant progress on these main two fires before we hit Sunday, but we're not out of the woods yet, and we could see more fires pop up Sunday into next week.
Yeah, so what's the percentage containment now for these two major fires, the Palisades and Eaton fires?
Palisades is at 8% containment, and it's consumed about 20,000 acres. Eaton is at 3% containment and about 14,000 acres. That's up from 0% yesterday morning. And so we're finally making progress. When we have these very strong winds, firefighters are just not able to really do anything about these fires. When they're on the defensive, they're focused primarily on keeping people alive, getting people evacuated, and saving whatever structures they can. They're not focused on that containment number, but with the winds turning around yesterday, they can finally act on the offensive.
And Noah, just given your role at the LA Times, I'm wondering how easy is it to get access as a journalist to what's happening on the ground there, given the ferocity of the fires, the fact that 200,000 people are under evacuation orders, or at least around that number. How are you able to get access? Are you able to get into some of these fire zones?
Yeah, luckily we have pretty good access. They've blocked off major roadways and have police stationed there to ensure that no residents are trying to return. As much as they want to check in on their properties, it is still not yet safe for them to return. So all those major roadways are blocked, but journalists have been allowed in. The fires here are creating their own weather. And so you can drive just a quarter of a mile and be in different conditions. Things can change on a dime. And so that's why officials really want to make sure that residents are not yet returning. On Tuesday night, they had a press conference at a state beach along the famous Pacific Coast Highway with Governor Newsom. And while it was safe at the start of the press conference, just an hour later, the fire was already approaching and had to evacuate the command center just after that. So that's how quickly the dynamics can change out here.
Well, with all these people evacuating, do you have a sense of where they're going or where they can go?
There hasn't been many official shelters designated. There have been some for individuals with pets and any larger animals like horses. Most folks that I have talked to are staying with friends, family. They're booking hotels or Airbnbs. A lot of hotels in the area are offering discounted prices. Airbnb has also started its program for discounted or free locations for individuals that are trying to find a spot. And as the fires slowly become controlled by fire crew and individuals are slowly returning to their homes or hearing whether or not their homes have survived or not, they're trying to get some longer term plans kind of pinned down. I've heard a few reports of luxury apartments in Santa Monica selling out all of their open units already. And so there's kind of a scramble for individuals to find this long-term housing. If they've lost their home, they're going to need to find a place for 1-2 years, even more, as they try to rebuild.
Well, of course, this is happening in the midst of what was already a dire housing shortage in LA. How is that factoring into the effort to get people a place to live, not only just short term, but even just starting to think now about the long term homes that people are going to need who have lost their homes in these fires?
We're expecting rents to increase in wake of the fires. You know, if there's fewer homes, then prices are expected to go up. The demand stays the same, but the supply here is lower. There's been a lot of controversy and issues with insurance as well. You know, a lot of these issues, especially in the Pacific Palisades, which is just a little bit outside of LA, it's a very hilly and mountainous area, out in the wildlands. It's a very fire prone area. And, you know, these areas can see fire like once every 20 years, once every 10 years. And so insurance companies are just less and less likely to provide insurance to these folks. And so we're entering a bit of an insurance crisis as well, as we try to grapple what it means to live in an area that is seeing fire so frequently.
Well, that insurance angle is just, we're going to need a whole show just to get into that and those impacts. Are you hearing so far from people who know that they've lost their homes, how they're doing in terms of interacting with insurance companies, or any guidance you could provide any listeners who are affected or know people who are affected by these fires?
Yeah, I haven't heard a ton from folks yet. They're kind of in the process of working with insurance. It seems like folks that do have insurance are getting through and able to talk to agents. And there's some work with government officials to try to expedite that process. However, there's a lot of folks that were living in homes that were uninsured or recently had insurance policies that were not renewed. And so they're going to have to face the cost of the loss here.
Yeah, I know. I have one colleague who did lose a home in the Palisades, was on the phone with an insurance agent yesterday, who told him, don't expect to be back into your home, wherever that may be, for at least 2 to 3 years. So that's just one anecdote, but I think speaks to just how long-term these impacts are going to be here. We're speaking with Noah Haggerty, environment, health, and science reporter at the LA Times, about what's happening on the ground in Los Angeles with all the devastating wildfires that are happening. And Noah, of course, this affects people not just directly in the fire zones, but throughout the region due to the smoke impacts, the air quality impacts. What's going on? What's the latest in terms of the air quality and how people are managing with that in the region?
The air quality over LA seems to slowly be improving, but it has been a citywide issue. No matter where you are in the city, you can smell smoke. And, you know, folks are rushing to get masks and things like that, but a lot of locations are sold out. It's difficult to get those N95 masks. Residents that are closer to the fire have not been as worried about air quality and are focused on staying safe and what has happened with their property. But the conditions have been changing fast. There's some areas that can see the clear sky, and there's some areas on Tuesday and Thursday where it looked like it was nighttime in the middle of the day because the smoke was so thick. You could spot these fires from pretty much anywhere in the city. And no matter where folks were in LA, the sense of anxiety was palpable. Family members and friends from outside LA were checking in on pretty much everyone living in the city. Folks that were not in evacuation areas were still concerned and packing go bags, trying to coordinate plans to head out of town for the time. So while these fires are mostly on the outskirts of LA, it's been affecting all of us here.
Well, let's talk about the evacuation procedures. What happened just when this fire first really, the fires really started up on Tuesday? You know, LA, of course, famous for congestion, and it looked like there was a lot of challenges for people getting out of some of these hilly communities. I saw images of bulldozers having to push abandoned cars out of the way. I have close family who took 2 hours to drive 0.8 miles to a main road, just sitting there trying to evacuate. Not clear what's happened with their home yet. They've been evacuated. But what were the procedures in place? Were they adequate? What could be done? Just thinking about the potential loss of life that could have happened with all these people stuck in line with their cars, unable to get out of their communities. Can you just talk about the procedures in place, what happened, and maybe what are some of the initial thoughts about what could be done going forward?
Yeah, the evacuations for the Pacific Palisades were especially challenging. And this is something that officials knew well before this fire. These are communities that live in very hilly, mountainous areas out in the wildlands that are prone to fires. And you have thousands and thousands of homes that are living in these somewhat remote areas with sometimes two or three potential evacuation routes. And that's it. And those are along winding roads. And so this fire broke out about 10:30 a.m. Witnesses in the area said they saw it immediately and saw it was growing very quickly. And the evacuation order came around noon. And so that was about an hour and a half later. And we're still trying to figure out what took so long to get that evacuation warning. And almost immediately, major roadways were gridlocked for miles. People described it as essentially a parking lot. And then the situation was worsened around 1 p.m. as individuals were trying to get from these hilly areas down to the coast. Along the evacuation routes at the coast, spot fires broke out pretty quickly. And so people that were stuck there in gridlock, there was police that kind of ran down the street and told people to essentially abandon their cars and run for their lives. And so people ran, you know, upward of half a mile down to the coast, leaving their cars blocking the evacuation routes. And so some individuals had volunteered themselves to go up and start moving these cars so that fire personnel could get up and fight these fires. But there's some areas where you know, we have these four-lane roads and all four lanes were used for evacuation and all four lanes were just covered with idle cars. And so they had to bring out bulldozers about, it seems like 1 or 2 hours later to just bulldoze a way through these cars so that fire crew could get up to these areas.
Well, in addition to the evacuation challenges, there have been reports that fire hydrants were essentially running dry. Can you talk about what's happening there? Is there adequate water? Is there adequate water pressure? And what is the explanation if there have been challenges getting the water needed to put these fires out?
Yeah, there's been a lot of criticism for the water infrastructure in LA and how it's held up during these fires. In general, Southern California has the water supply that it needs. The trouble is moving it to where it's needed. So officials said that for about 15 hours during the beginning of these fires on Tuesday, water demand was four times what it normally is. And the system is just not designed to handle that. There's about 114 massive water tanks across the city that hold water to be used for these systems. The Department of Water and Power says that they were all completely full at the start of the fire. There's three of these tanks in the Palisades, and they quickly ran dry. Each of these hold about 1 million gallons of water each. The first one had run dry around 4:45 p.m. Tuesday, another one at 8:30 p.m., and then the final one 3 a.m. on Wednesday. And so firefighters were just pulling water from these much faster than officials in the Department of Water and Power could refill the tanks. And there was additional challenges because there was some power outages. Some were planned for safety reasons and some were because of the fires. And with power outages, you lose the ability to pump water uphill to these holding tanks and to fire personnel where they're needed up in these Pacific highlands. And so that created additional challenges. To kind of alleviate some of it, the Department of Water and Power brought in tankers, and so they were physically driving water to firefighters that needed it. Once the winds died down, aircraft were able to obtain water from the ocean and dump it on the fire. However, firefighters generally don't like to rely on using salty water because it can severely damage the ecosystem for a very long time after it's dropped on these regions. And it also places a lot of stress on the mechanical equipment in the planes.
Well, these water shortages remind me of the lessons learned in 1906 San Francisco, you know, that we had a similar challenge in the Bay Area in San Francisco with lack of water. And the city responded by building an auxiliary water system, cisterns throughout the city. And I wonder if the same kind of lessons are going to have to be incorporated into Los Angeles to expand the infrastructure for what is, it seems almost inevitable that these kinds of crises are going to keep happening given the way that the climate is going. And I just want to let listeners know, this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Ethan Elkind sitting in for Rose Aguilar. We're talking about the latest on the wildfires in Los Angeles County. We're joined by Noah Haggerty, environment, health, and science reporter at the LA Times. Noah is on the ground with several of his colleagues at the LA Times covering these fires. And Noah, you were just talking about the personnel and the infrastructure that being deployed to try to address these fires. The Guardian has reported that nearly 800 incarcerated firefighters have deployed to battle these wildfires. Governor Newsom has announced that he's more than 7,500 firefighting and emergency personnel have also been deployed. Can you just talk about just the army of people that are trying to limit the damage and have hopefully put these fires out in LA? What is that like on the ground?
Yeah, California has a massive mutual aid system for fires like these. So as early as Saturday before the fires, officials in the state, including Governor Newsom, were planning for this extreme wind event where wildfires were expected. And they moved a lot of resources from Northern California down to Southern California starting on Sunday. And those were placed kind of up and down the Southern California coast. As soon as the Palisades fire broke out, they entered unified command with CAL FIRE as well. That happened around noon. On the ground, I've seen fire crews from San Francisco working, Santa Cruz, Santa Barbara, all these places. We know that the California National Guard has been called in to help. We have these incarcerated folks that are helping as well. We also know that the Los Angeles Fire Department put out a notice and asked any off-duty firefighters with the department to call in and give their availability. So everyone that is available is working around the clock to fight these fires.
And Noah, what about climate change? How much is the climate crisis fueling this disaster? I know, you know, this can be an area of controversy, even just within those who accept climate change, you know, understanding the link between the science and specific weather events. And of course, we have, you know, many climate deniers in this country and among our political class who would reject that there's any connection. But what are you hearing just from climate scientists about the connection between climate change and this fire? We know fires are a part of life in California or our Mediterranean climate, but to have these kinds of dry conditions in January, to have wildfires in what should be one of the wettest months of the year, can you talk about how much we might be able to attribute this to what's happening with our global climate?
Yeah, the fires in Southern California are getting worse for a few factors. Climate change is one of them. Officials or scientists call it a climate whiplash. The climate is just getting much more unpredictable, and the extremes are getting more extreme here. And normally, you know, we expect a fire season around the fall time, maybe early winter. And Governor Newsom has dubbed it fire year now. It's less predictable when these wildfires could happen. These severe wind conditions with really dry brush on the ground and these powerful winds blowing in from the dry desert out to the coast are becoming worse. The National Weather Service recently even added a new category. They have the red flag warnings for the worst wind conditions, and then they now have particularly dangerous situations for the most extreme cases of these winds. And they've been using that new designation pretty frequently. We also have a pretty dangerous feedback loop that has started within the ecosystem itself, that started once humans from Europe started colonizing California. So way back before the time of colonization, wildfire was a part of the land. However, the land would see it once every 30 years to once every 130 years. And pretty much all of those wildfires were started by lightning. The fires would clear out the land, and then over the next 30 plus years, the native brush would grow back. But once humans moved in, we've increased the potential for ignition. So when you have cars driving along roadways that can spark things, you have power lines that can create sparks, where now I think it's more than 95% of wildfires are started by people and not lightning. And so we just have a lot more ignition sources. And with fires that are happening as frequently as like once every 10 years, there's just not enough time for the native species to grow back. And humans have introduced plenty of very flammable invasive brush species that can grow back in a single year. And so when you have these frequent fires that are happening too fast for the native species to grow back, you just create this opportunity for the invasive species to grow in, which just creates more opportunity for fire.
And I'm sure this will be studied for years to come by climate scientists as well. We're getting close to the end here of our time with you, Noah. Wanted to also ask just quickly about the economic impacts here. Of course, some major events coming up in LA, football games, award shows, but also just everyday people. I mean, we think about some of these high income areas that are burning, but there's a lot of low income people dependent on jobs, you know, housekeepers, landscapers that are going to be out of work for, you know, foreseeable future. What are your thoughts and what are you hearing in terms of the economic fallout of this wildfire?
The economic fallout is huge. AccuWeather predicted that the cost of damages and just disruption to life could top $50 billion, making it one of the most expensive disasters in American history. And while the Palisades area is pretty well off and high end, around the Eaton Fire, that is a very low-income community, so it is not just the celebrities and elite who are affected by the wildfires here. People across the city are feeling the impacts. Just driving around these areas, the devastation is hard to describe. There are communities that are completely wiped out and gone, entire neighborhoods, entire communities that will have to completely rebuild. And so we'll be feeling the impacts for years to come.
Well, Noah, just last question for you. How are you and your colleagues at the LA Times and in the media in general, how are you planning to cover the fires in the coming days? What can we expect in terms of reporting from you?
Yeah, we've spent the past few days reporting what is happening, and we're going to be spending the next week into the next months and years kind of reflecting on what happened, what went wrong, and how we can better address these issues moving forward.
Well, we'll stay tuned for that. Really appreciate you coming on. I can't even imagine the hours you're putting in right now to bring the story to not just those in LA who are affected, but really the whole world. Noah Haggerty, environment, health, and science reporter at the LA Times. Thank you so much for joining us on Your Calls Media Roundtable.
Thanks for having me.
This is Ethan Elkon. I'm sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and we'll be back with Your Calls Media Roundtable, with an investigation by ProPublica on how a health insurance company has been denying and limiting coverage and access to care for children with autism. That's coming up after this short break, so stay with us.